What does it take for the world to fall apart? What does it take for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give up on us and decide to get rid of the whole thing? We all have a sense of the answer. Anyone who's aware of the events described in this week's Parsha and of Chazal's understanding of the events in this week's Parsha. So we're generally familiar with the answers to that question. What is it that made that decision come, that humanity is done for? And the Torah tells us that the land was filled with chamas, and the rabbis teach us, Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin, that lo nechtema gzardinam ela al hagezel, that what sealed their fate, what made this the decision, was theft, was taking other people's property. And it's a very striking statement, somewhat baffling, because Chazal also tell us that they did other things too. They did other things that would seem to be worse, other things that generally were the Gimel Chamuros, the three Harivo Yavors they were guilty of. So why did it take Gezel? Why was Gezel held up as being worse than everything else? There are various suggestions. The Avnei Nezer was quoted as saying that, in a sense, Gezel has aspects of all the other three. In a minor way, it's comparable to all of the big three. It's comparable on some conceptual level to Gilui Arayos, because it involves pursuing something that's not meant for you. It's comparable to Ritzicha, because it involves a willingness to take at the expense of others, and who knows how far you would go with that. But perhaps most pointedly, it involves an aspect of Avodah Zarah, because it's essentially a denial of the fact that God is watching and that God controls the world. And if you believe that it's going to make a difference, you want to be richer, you want to have more, and you think it's going to help to take from that which belongs to others, and you can somehow get around God's plan, or you don't believe he has a plan, or that he's watching. So that speaks of Avodah Zarah. That has an idolatrous component to it. And it's perhaps that which resonates most powerfully here, and could perhaps also help us to understand other aspects of what Chazal say about their fate and what brought it about. And the Medrash Rabbah and the Yerushalmi tell us, also a very familiar statement, that it's not just that they were involved in stealing, but they had a way of doing it. They would take less than a shava pruta. They would find a way to be just under the radar, just under the threshold that could be prosecuted, and that was what really did it. The fact that they came up with this plan to steal in a way that was not even noticeable, not prosecutable, less than a shava pruta, that was really what was terrible. And that takes the amazement another step further. It's hard enough to understand why Gezel was the final straw, but specifically this type of Gezel, that you're going under the radar, may not even be defined as stealing. There are different sources as far as the Gemaras and the Rambams, whether that's actually called gezel. Is it possible to steal something so small doesn't have even monetary status? So why that makes it worse is itself a fascinating idea. And it seems that this goes beyond the idea of appropriating somebody else's property. But this creates a fundamental dishonesty in society that really makes everything collapse. This is a point that Rav Hirsch makes in his commentary, where he notes that the world could never be filled, could never be mole, gezel, because we have courts and we have judicial systems, and there are things in place that will take action if people are stealing in an overt way that's prosecutable. That's not going to be able to overtake the land. But this kind of activity, this kind of beneath-the-radar dishonesty, which is never enough to to get prosecuted, and completely relies on conscience in order for it to be reined in, for it to be controlled, that could fill up the world. And that could make everything collapse, and that could destroy society. And it's a powerful concept because this category of types of theft, of appropriation, of stealing that don't actually qualify as prosecutable theft, which could never be hauled into a bezdin and punished, there are many such types, many such categories. Perhaps one of the most powerful, one of the most impactful, is what we call gnevas das. Essentially, taking somebody's good impression without earning it, deceiving someone in a consequential way. This is certainly in that category. It's not something that you can get thrown in jail for. It's not something you can be forced to repay. It's not something that a Beis Din can prosecute. And yet, we know from many places in Shas, many places in Chazal, that it's a tremendous prohibition. The Gemara in Maseches Chulin, the Yeshiva learned Chulin a few years ago. The Gemara tells us in no uncertain terms, Aser ligno of das habrios, afilo shalakum. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. But what's perhaps more striking is that the Tosefta in Bava Kamma lists many different types of ganavim, many different types of thieves. And it says that the gonev das is the first. Gonev das, in a sense, is at the top of the list. And the Tosefta even says that somebody who's gonev das would be willing, if he could pull it off, to even do that to a Kadosh Baruch Hu himself. That it's not simply that you want to take somebody else's property and it's not yours, as bad as that is. But this is a level of deception that is so fundamental, is so personal, that it's ke'ilu, you are ignoring God completely. He knows what's inside. He knows what's true. And yet you're willing to present yourself in a false fashion. That, Tosefta suggests, is the worst of all. It's a staggering idea. And I know this is billed as a sichas musar, not as a halacha shir. But sometimes the most powerful musar is just to look at the halacha, but also to look at the discussions in halacha and see what poskim thought about and what they considered and the svaros and the explanations that they sometimes put forward. Sometimes that can be the most powerful musar. So if you could just take a minute or two to consider one or two halachic discussions in the realm of gnevas das, see some fascinating things. For example, the Gemara in Maseches Chulin and Daf Tzadi Daled, where the sugya appears. So the Gemara makes it clear that let's say you're hosting a guest and you want to create the impression that you're a very generous host, you're very gracious, you're going all out for this guest. So you make it look like you're opening up a whole package of something that's going to go to waste otherwise, but you're doing it specially for them because they're such an honored guest. But the truth is, it's not really for them. It was open anyway. You have some other purpose for all the rest of it. So you're not really doing it in order to honor them, but you let them think that that's the purpose. So you get their goodwill. They're going to be grateful. They're going to feel like they're being treated with the royal treatment. And really, it's not the case. You're doing this anyway. So the Gemara says that's prohibited. That's an example of gnevas das. And yet, the Gemara does mention there could be exceptions, there could be situations where it's not so bad. So one possibility that's mentioned by the Gemara, it's not clear whether it's a conclusion or not, but the Gemara mentions that if, yes, it's true, this package you would have opened anyway, or it was committed for something else anyway, but still you would have done it for this guest. That had you needed to open it specially for this guest, you would have done it. So then, okay, that's not called gnevas das. That's what it sounds like, at least according to one answer in the Gemara. However, the Rambam doesn't bring it. And it's the question why the Rambam doesn't quote that exception. Beis Yosef says, well, maybe he doesn't bring it because it's obvious. Very logical, it makes sense, that if really you would have treated this guest in grand style, so then it's okay to let him think that you were actually doing that. And it doesn't have to spell it out. But others weren't so sure. The Lecha Mishnah points out over there, it's not necessarily so obvious, and it's not clear that everyone agrees. And it's possible that the Rambam doesn't agree. So if that's the case, so why not? It does seem to make sense. If the point is that you would have honored this guest anyway if you had needed to go all out, and you genuinely have that kind of esteem for him, so then why can't we be satisfied with that? Why is it that we wouldn't rely, according to some, maybe according to the Rambam, on this idea that you don't have to explain that it wasn't specially for him, if you would have done it specially for him if you had to? And there are a few suggestions, and as we'll note, a number of the points we'll mention, these suggestions show us tremendous insight, and later on, academics came on to the same insight. So here, for example, the Sefer Lev Aryeh in Maseches Chulin, Lev Aryeh writes that it's not so simple to say that, well, I'm not doing this special for you, but I would have. Because we may think so, we may want to think so, but how do we really know when we're really tested, when it's really at the moment, and we're asked to come through with the image that we have of ourselves, when we say, oh, if I was rich, I would give so much money to tzedakah. It's easy to say when you're not rich. But when you actually become rich, and then you have to follow through, will you stand up to the test? You may like to believe that you would, but perhaps you wouldn't. So perhaps you don't have the right to say that I would have done this and therefore I can count it as already done. You have to actually pass that test in real life in order to be able to claim that. And as I indicated, this is something that later has been validated by academics. For example, Jonathan Haidt in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, notes, as others do, that we all have a tendency to overestimate our virtue. So to assume that, yes, if I was put in this position, I would rise up to the test, but who knows? Sure you think that. I'm sure you believe it honestly in the moment, but until it happens, who knows? And it's fascinating that there is a statement, a very well-known statement, the Gemara in the end of Maseches Makos, which applies to Rav Safra, the language of Dover Emes Belavavo, that he was someone who spoke the truth even in his heart. And we're probably familiar with the backstory, but may miss the point that it's actually not in the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't tell us how we know that Rav Safra was a Dover Emes Belavavo. What's often associated with this is what Rashi says over there. Rashi quotes from the She'iltos that the reason Rav Safra was praised as a Dover Emes Belavavo is because once he was in the middle of saying Kriya Shema, and somebody wanted to buy something from him, and he made an offer, and Rav Safra had in mind to accept the offer, but he couldn't interrupt Kriya Shema, and it went on for a little while, and the person kept raising the offer, and then afterwards Rav Safra insisted on sticking with the original offer because he had in mind to go with that, and even though the purchaser would never have known, he thought he was negotiating, still he was so honest he stuck with what he had committed to. So that's often quoted as the meaning of Dover Emes Belavavo, because it's what Rashi quotes from the She'iltos. If you look in the Maariv Chayis, in the back of the Aramakos, so he quotes from other Svarim, that there's another theory as to why Rav Safra is called Dover Emes Belavavo. It's because of this kind of insight. That same sugi in Chulin, Gemara tells the story where Rav Safra was walking and he encountered Mar Zutra, I believe, and Mar Zutra said, wow, it's so nice that you came out special to greet me, which wasn't the case. He just happened to stumble upon him in the street. And Mar Zutra got the impression that he was coming specially to honor him. He said, thank you so much for coming to honor me. And Rav Safra said, actually, I didn't. I had no idea you were coming. But if I did, then I hope I would have gone to great lengths to honor you. And he was asked, why do you have to say anything? Why do you have to tell him that? You're making him feel bad. He was happy to think that you came to honor him. And now you have to point out that you didn't actually do that, when even you're saying now that had you known, you would have liked to have treated him specially. So says the Maariv Chayis that that's why he's Dover Emes Belavavo. He's Dover Emes Belavavo because this representation of himself as who he would like to be, that's an aspiration. Hopefully he'll live up to that. But can he claim credit for having done that when he hasn't actually practiced it yet? That's too much. A fascinating insight into just how far Gneivas Das asks us to go. To give one other quick example, so the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, if you're selling something, let's say you're selling meat, and you want to puff it up to make it look like there's more to it, like it's a fattier piece of meat. So the Gemara says, that's a problem. That's deceptive. What kind of problem it is, a little bit of a discussion. If you're going to sell it at a higher price because you're going to make it look like it's fresher or more, so then that's outright fraud, that's onah, that's stealing money. But let's say you're not going to charge more, but you let the purchaser think they're getting a better deal because it's fresher or fatter than it looks. So then that's Gneivas Das. That's the prohibition of giving them the impression they're getting a better deal or they're going to jump on this purchase because of that under false pretenses. So that you're not allowed to do. But what if everyone does it? What if it's the minig? What if it's known that it's always presented this way? That meat is always served in the butchers with this greater enhancement to make it look a little bigger. And purchasers know that. They come in, they know this is the way presentation is done. I have to mentally subtract a little bit. So then what? Is it okay? So the Sma and the Nesivus and Mishpat, they say, yeah, it's okay. But others said, no, it's not okay. Divrei Malkiel, Vizyakov, they say, no, even if it's known that this is the minig, this is the way it's done, it's still not okay. You're still not allowed to do it. Why not? If people know, what's the problem? So there are various suggestions. Some say, well, maybe there are some people who don't know, and maybe we have to be so careful, we can't rely on the average person. We have to make sure everyone is aware. So therefore, even if it's a minig, maybe there are some who will forget that it's a minig or won't be aware that it's a minig. Maybe we have to worry about them. But the Divrei Malkiel says that in a particularly interesting way. He says that it's not good enough that the purchaser knows that this isn't really what it's look like, what it looks like. Because he can't actually see, he can't actually visualize what it really does look like. And that's a problem. And what seems to be suggesting here, as others explain more clearly, that even if you know something intellectually, but it looks to you different, it's presented in a way that doesn't represent what it actually is, it can still fool you. It can overtake your intellectual knowledge that there's something else going on here. And this, again, was validated more recently by academics in Yale and Harvard, the theory called the G.I. Joe fallacy. It was put forward by academics named Santos and Gendler, who said that knowing is not as much of the battle as you may think, and that even if you believe you know something intellectually, but it's not presented to you visually that way, you still can forget. You still can make a decision based on what you see rather than what you know to be true. And I saw once in the writings of Moshe Mordechai Karp, who's a great posek, who wrote the Hilchos Chag V'Chag and others for him, that he thought it was a Gneivas Das problem, what every store ever in the history of anything does, be a huge problem if he's correct, that we call 99 pricing, to charge $19.99 instead of $20, $9.99 instead of $10. So that's a problem with Gneivas Das. And again, the whole world does that, so it's pretty scary if that is a problem. And the initial reaction was, but everyone knows. Everyone knows that that's what it costs. They see that number in front of them. They know that every store ever in history charges that way. So $9.99 is $10, they understand. And yet, in this study, these academics wrote specifically giving that example. But even though you know that $19.99 is really $20, but your mind processes $19.99 in a very different way than $20. And you'll make your decisions based on it being a lower number, even though essentially it's the same number. Even though for all intents and purposes, especially after they add on all the extra fees, it's the same number, but your mind processes it as something less, even though you know. And the Sefer Ole Yaakov, he points out, we know this, because let's say, for example, we want to make sure to get somewhere on time, so we set our watches ahead. Even though we know we set our watches ahead, but it's able to fool us, we're able to trick ourselves by having a different visual representation. And that's what's being highlighted here, that there is a level of honesty that the halacha is requiring of us that is so precise, that is so demanding, that we have to continuously think, are we indeed living up to its standards? So certainly it doesn't need to be said, not in this room. We talk about tests in an academic setting. So there, it goes without saying, and the poskim who said it thought it should go without saying, but Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Osner and the Shuvah Shevet Halevi, when asked about cheating on tests under the guise of some kind of good reason, some kind of good cause, all said, and Vosner said very powerfully, I don't understand what the question. I'm baffled. It's clear that that's Gnevas Das. It's clear that you're looking to get benefit to create an impression that is false and that that is unequivocally prohibited by the Talmud. It's clear that that is deceptive and dishonest and that goes against all of the values that we're meant to live by. So I don't understand what the question is. I don't understand how it even can be brought up. It should go without saying. So here, we don't need to focus on that because we do understand that it's clear that to cheat on an examination in a university or any such setting, certainly a violation of Gneva's Das in the fullest sense, but really more than that, really of monetary Gneva also, because of the impact that it has on all kinds of financial decisions and ramifications later. So that we can all understand. But perhaps what our parsha gives us a greater appreciation for is it's not only that extreme that would trigger such a great violation, but that there are opportunities here, that these tests and all the other tests that we go through in life on a daily basis are opportunities to refine our sense of honesty, our integrity, which means that we are complete and whole within ourselves. These are all opportunities that we can utilize to make sure that we further have refined what it means to have that sense of integrity and to construct ourselves, and perhaps through that, to put the world back together again. Thank you very much.